Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. We got the rolling podium here. It's my favorite part. We're having a celebration. When is this in 2 weeks?
30th.
The 30th. The group celebration. Anybody that's celebrated an anniversary in that last quarter, please feel free to join us in a celebration. Our friend Lena is going to be doing a workshop with a whole bunch of her women for 8 weeks, starting next week. It's going to be phenomenal. Lena's been on fire lately, and we know some of her sponsees who are going to be participating in it. So highly recommended. Especially tell as many women as you can, because it'll be really, really beneficial for them. I'm absolutely sure. You know, it was 11 years ago or so that this group, this home group started. This group started with a bunch of people that were coming over to my house for a couple of years, and we were just going through the big book, and we were doing the best we could trying to work the steps out of the book. And historically, what happened was some people who knew the priest at this church had come over to my house and gone through the steps with us in a group. And the priest noticed the change in these guys and started asking some questions. And they basically said what was going on. So the priest from this church actually tracked me down at a commitment in NetCon and corralled me after the meeting and said, you know, would you consider starting a meeting in our church, doing whatever you're doing over in your house? It was a very, very interesting because, I was a little hesitant to do it. At this period of time, there were step meetings, there were discussion meetings, there were speaker meetings. There were no meetings where Chris taught from the big book, you know. So I knew I would probably not be the most popular person around. But the situation basically was that this priest asked us to do it. You know, you have to pay attention to things like that. So 11 years ago, you know, we came into this room and we started a couple of meetings, and it's been a pretty decent home group. I've met some extraordinary people at this meeting, and there's some really great friends that I've made out of here. And I'm incredibly blessed to have been able to participate in this home group. In my work life, I revolve around some people who actually work in and around the professional treatment field, and with some of these events, I've met some extraordinary people, and you know, one of them is with us here tonight. Jeff was very generous to fly all the way down here to go to this meeting. He was going to be in the area anyway because he had a Washington D.C. gig that he was doing, but that got canceled. And he said, "Well, I made a commitment. I'm going to this group anyway." He very easily could have canceled, but he flew all the way down to Toronto in bad weather to be here with us, and I'm really grateful. He's much too humble to blow his own horn, but I will tell you that this guy is flying around the world doing some really, really important work for us. You know what I mean? He's tied in with the UN, and he's tied in with international organizations, and he's making a difference out there, trying to improve the quality of treatment, trying to improve the quality of our lives as sufferers from addictive illness. So it is absolutely with my pleasure that I am going to bring up my very good friend, Jeff W. from the Toronto area. Jeff.
Well, my friends, my name is Jeff, and I am an alcoholic. Well, I'll tell you, right about now, the guys that I hang out with on Tuesday night are cracking the big book. I understand this is a big book study group, and I belong to one up in Cambridge, Ontario, just an hour out of Toronto. But I said to the guys, look, I won't be here next Tuesday. I think I'll fly down to New Jersey to get a decent cup of coffee, and it is very good. Thank you so much, Chris, for those kind words. None of them are true, really. I'm just a dumb old country boy. But I'm a double winner. You know, God takes care of drunks and fools. I qualify for both, and so I am just really pleased to be here. You can walk into these rooms no matter where it is, and you get that feeling. My good wife Diane says, you know, I just love going to the meetings, but there's something about the bond between you alcoholics. And I experience that just walking in the door, shaking your hand, and my name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic, right? I want to tell you right off the bat that the most precious words in my vocabulary is the word recovery. It's more than just sticking the cork in the bottle, putting the bottles of pills away. I've been given a life beyond my imagination. And I will share just a little bit of that with you. What a pleasure it is to stand here in Bardensville and to say, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic. I've been called certain other things, and I've called myself certain other things over the years. I'm going to tell you, this is my alcoholism. Chris and I and Mary Beth are going to go up for a bite to eat after this meeting, so I'm going to keep it real short. I could do it in about 5 minutes here, I think. I was released from the psychiatric hospital getting near the end of my journey, my drinking journey. And I couldn't get a job in accounting, or I couldn't get a job in sales and marketing anymore. I was pumping gas at the bottom of Shaunce Hill in Preston, Ontario. I was so squirreled up that if you happened to be out on vacation and dropped in there and I filled your tank, I probably didn't get your money. I was just so screwed up. And I had a challenge. My oldest guy was 10 then. His name is Derek, big cop type guy now. And he had a championship ball game. He played with Ducey, who eventually played for the Blue Jays. I know none of you here cheer for the Blue Jays, but I do on occasion. And it was important for me to get to that ball game. As much as I could in my drunken student mind, I loved those boys, those three boys of mine. And I want to get to the ball game. Well, you know, if I go route A, I've got to get by three bars. If I go by route B, there's just two bars. And if I go route C, I just got to get by Nick's Tavern. Now, I don't know how I had a car and insurance and all of that, but somehow I did. Now, if this gets really foggy for you, say, well, God, this guy's really chaotic. It's chaotic in my own mind after 33 years. So trying to figure out what's the truth and what isn't. So I headed out with the greatest determination to get to the ball game. Mile and a half. Nick's Tavern. With the greatest determination, fired up the car, and somewhere between that gas station and Nick's Tavern, I heard the voice. Have you heard the voice? I'm sure you have. One won't hurt you. Now you know I didn't get to the ball game. And you know that I woke up, came to, looking at the disappointment and loathing in my children's eyes. Looking at the loathing in my ex-wife's eyes. And then to have the look in the mirror, how much I loathed me. That's my alcoholism. A little while ago, a couple of years ago, I was sitting with the cops at his table with his 8-year-old son at that point, the hockey player. Now, as you know, I cheer for the Devils down here every once in a while, depending who they're playing, as long as they're not playing Montreal. The hockey player just loved it. Saturday, goal and assist. He just did a nice play. And as you know, in Canada, hockey is not a sport, it's a religion. And we were sitting at the table, and he was doodling or coloring or something, and frankly, I had the weight of the world on my shoulders. I guess I got in touch with those C4 recovery guys or what have you. I had this weight on my shoulders. A real serious problem. Didn't know how to do it. And young Caleb looked up at me and said, Grandpa, you know what? I said, what? He said, I love you. The weight, of course, lifted right off my shoulders. What was so important? That's recovery. So you can understand when I say that the most precious word in my vocabulary is recovery. I could stop right there and go home, finish my coffee and go home. And I've really told the story of my addiction, of my recovery. But let me tell you just a little bit of the story. You know, Gordon Lightfoot, great Canadian songwriter and poet, wrote in a song, some words in one of his songs, about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Remember the song? About the American ship, the sunken Canadian waters in Lake Superior. And in that song, Lightfoot writes, "Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?" I can't hear that song without feeling what those crew on that ship felt. The despair, the crying out, knowing that you were absolutely doomed, that there was no way out. I don't know about you, my fellow brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous here. I understand that feeling. I know what it's to be at the end, seeing no light at all. And yet somehow, a power much greater than myself reached down, grasped me, and put me up on the shore. I started out drinking, I know many of you, and I really believe that. I know that you started drinking, you did so safely. You drank for a while and what have you, and then you crossed the magic line. I also know some of you tell me that you drank a 40-pounder a day. I couldn't have done that. It would kill me. Of course, you took all day to drink it. I'd taken about an hour and a half, perhaps, to drink that. All I can tell you is that not only was I in trouble, did I have a problem. I was a problem right off the bat. I'm the kind of kid, at 15 or 14, that your parents said, "Don't ever have him back in our house." Anybody identify? Okay. So they actually punched a hole in the fridge or the wall or did something erratic. I had difficulty right off the bat. In fact, at 16 years of age, I found myself a couple of thousand miles away from home on our East Coast, up in Nova Scotia, in a county jail, about to be sentenced to prison for 5 years. And booze was involved. I loved that Orleans schooner up there. They had quart bottles. You didn't have to go to the fridge as often. I didn't go to prison. I got a police escort out of the province of Nova Scotia, told never to return. And you know, it was a hockey coach and a police officer who knew me as a kid and knew that I wasn't a bad kid until they picked up the drink. And they went to bat for us from Ontario, the people of Nova Scotia. And frankly, I don't even remember going back and saying thank you to those people. A short while later, well, a few years later, I was actually working on a consulting contract with the Attorney General of Canada, the Correction Service Canada, the guys running these prisons across our country. And I really expected that as I came into the Halifax airport, I expected a tap on the shoulder saying, "Wilby, didn't we tell you to get out of here back in 59? What a privilege, again, recovery. I love the eastern part of our country, eastern part of your country, right where we are. And we're down there on vacation, Diane and I, my wife, and now most people go down to Peggy's Cove and take pictures. Halifax is a beautiful city if you haven't ever had the experience of being there. Not me. I wanted to go to Windsor down the Annapolis Valley to visit the county jail. Interesting enough, you know, most people take pictures at Peggy's Cove and what have you. I'm standing outside the county jail. It's no longer operative, but the building's still there. You know, God has a sense of humor. The next day we're at Peggy's Cove to take some pictures. The camera blew up. Now, God has never called me on the phone. I wish he would. I wish he'd call me and say, "Jeff, you're doing okay." That's all she'd have to say. And I could move on. But I took that to say, you know something? Maybe that's a higher power telling me to put that in the past. Because one of the things I really felt bad about was my dear old mom when I was a kid finding out that I was in jail or in trouble with the law again in the newspapers. And it's funny what you do remember. I remember getting a letter from her saying, "Jeffrey, I thought you were smarter than that." That hurt. So I get back to Ontario. I'll just tell you another little story here just so you realize that I'm not here because my toenails are too long or anything of that nature. Four drunken punks rolls a car over. It was a 1954 Mercury convertible. We rolled it over at very high speeds. And when the police officer came up to the hospital to put the cuffs on me, he said, "I've been on the force for 23 years. I remember it as plain as day. And we thought we'd be picking you guys up with a dustpan. My thought was, he's just trying to scare me. Now, I tell you, when I pick up a drink, I have no defense. And I got to remind myself that I'm an alcoholic. I got my feet firmly planted in midair. And so part of the things were coming in, Mary Beth said, well, somebody, there'll be one person in the room who gets some help tonight. I said, yeah, and I know who it is. It'll be Jeff. I stood in front of the judge, and they read out the charges. And I didn't remember anything about a gun. But apparently, we were heading out that night with a sawed-off .22 to ride to rob the Highland Light Infantry of Canada at the armories. They had FNC-1s and all these weapons, and we were going to rob them. Four drunken punks with a sawed-off .22. But I got to tell you, the higher power did for us what we could not do ourselves. We were so drunk, we were heading the wrong way. I got up to the county jail, and my buddies, I said to them, what's going on? Because I couldn't remember. And I stood in front of the judge, and to this day, his name was J.R.H. Kirkpatrick. And the Crown Attorney, or what do you call it, the public attorney prosecuting, was Harold Doffman. Funny how you don't forget their names. And I stood in front of J.R. and said, he said, anything to say, young man? I said, well, sir, Your Honor, I've been in front of you time before. And he said, yes, you have. Your record's right here. And I said, I realized we could have been killed. Something, some kind of realization. I said, I'd like to have a break. And J.R.H. did me a real favor. I didn't understand it at the time. He said, well, young man, I hope you feel that way when you get out. And he sent me off to a little place that the government was running, a little institution there where there were fellows wearing blue uniforms and others wearing brown. The brown guys got to tell the guys in the blue uniforms what to do. And we moved hills for 6 cents a day. And I remember going in front of, they did some testing, and the psychologist that tested me said to the parole board or what have you, this guy is a pretty bright kid. We should be sending him off to an institution where he can get some training and get him an early parole. I stood up in front of the parole board, and they asked me about this episode. And my excuse and my retort was, well, I was drunk. Because in my mind, that justified what I was doing, that I wasn't responsible. They did me a real favor. Parole denied. Institution transferred denied. I didn't understand that. I understand a little bit today. There was a time later on when I was working in the corrections area, running an agency, and I remember it just as plain as day. A writing on this man's record, who had been deparoled to us, that in my opinion, if you can imagine, my opinion, this man needs to be in a controlled psychiatric setting. He had taken somebody's life, and I really knew, because I understood the headspace he was in, that it could happen again. As I signed it, I put the pen down, and I remember the thoughts of, who do I think I am to have been write this on another man's life? And if I'd ever heard God's voice, I heard it that day. So if I stayed your hand, you should understand. I understand, J.R.H. Kirkpatrick. I understand the parole board now. I understand the favor that they did me. So I got to tell you, I eventually got released. And I did what I think every good alcoholic should do. I married the Sunday school and the music teacher. I tried to buy some bits of stability by getting married. I was 19 years of age and obviously had the ability to deal with that kind of mature relationship. You know, I started to study. I bought a house 2 days after I could hold a mortgage in my own name. At that time, you had to be 21 to be able to have a mortgage. These three babies came along. I had a wonderful hedge, this house. That's what I was doing, was playing house. And on the outside, it looked like I was doing real well. Except for Friday night, I worked hard all week. I was promoted in the company I was with. I was ordering people around who've been on the job longer than I've been on the earth. And on the outside, it looks like we were doing real good. On the inside, my alcoholism was growing and growing. Missing moving days and birthdays and what have you. Hearing the voice, one won't hurt me. I recall coming to pick up my then no, ex-wife, my wife, and telling her that I had just spent the best $75 of my life. I'd gone to see a psychiatrist. And he asked me a question. He said, "Do you think you're an honest man?" And I answered it honestly. I said, "You know, I don't think I am." And he said, "You know, you should get out of that accounting business and look at another job." There it is. I'll just get into sales and marketing. I've just been in the wrong job. That's been the problem. Denial, lack of humility. I had a big job with a major company. It's going under, like a lot of our companies are going under. And I was in the cost accounting department and had the responsibility, this was back in 67, 68, of $80 million. It wasn't my money, I was supposed to count it. And I remember going out to a party with the vice president, one of the most interesting men I ever know. He moved on to take over CEO of a major Canadian company. And we were having a little bit of a wine party. And in fact, we were racing each other up and down an expressway that hadn't been opened yet. And I decided I would drop down and see the divorced wife, friends of ours, and they'd gotten divorced, and she had contacted us a couple of weeks prior to that. And so I picked up a bottle of Canadian Club and dropped over to see her. Now, I've made some wonderful decisions in my life, particularly those under the influence. And she said, "You know, you're so bloody boring. You used to be so much fun. What's this accounting kind of gig that you're in?" And she said, "Why don't you come and stay with me? Get out your old Gibson J45, and I think you could actually make it in the entertainment business." So now I'm down there doing these auditions. Now, she did offer some other benefits that I was interested in. So I just walked into my home, said to my ex-wife and three children, "Well, that's it, I'm going to go out and play with Johnny Cash or something. I'm going to become a country and western singing star." Left her the house, a little bit of money in the bank. I just took my golf clubs, my clothes, and my guitar. When it talks about in the book of us being errant little boys and little girls, I identify. What a totally irresponsible thing to do. And I ran around doing some auditions and what have you. And I remember walking into a recording company, and we had, you'll get a kick out of this, Chris, we'd done a little cassette in a bar that I was playing in, right? Took it into the recording company, and I really believed they'd say, "Gee, whoa, sit down. We'll be out with a contract in 20 minutes. That was back in 1969, and they haven't called yet. But I really believe that every once in a while, that company's still going, that when things aren't so good, they say, "Think we got a problem. Listen, this guy came in back in 69 and played this thing." But I'm trying to say, I had no humility. I was so screwed up, okay, that I didn't realize many times that I had humiliated myself. Drinking and pulling was all part of it. I ended up going into a phone call. I took enough mandrax and enough scotch or something to water it down, and left my wife then a note. "Please help me. I'm going to kill myself." Now, I was going to do it in a very noble way, and I've heard many of you in these podiums say the same thing. "I'm going to run my car into an abutment so she gets the insurance." And okay, now I don't want to get too smashed up, okay, because I want everybody wailing around the coffin. And the next thing I know is a phone call from the physician who said, "Jeff, we'd like you go to the psychiatric hospital for a rest for a couple of weeks." And I said, "Well, doc, I don't think I really need that." And he said, "Well, this is the way it is, Jeff. Either you go up voluntarily or we're going to come in and get you." Now, I had mixed feelings, and I walked into that locked ward. My grandmother, my father's side, had spent 28 years in the psychiatric hospital where she died. And walking through those doors with two feelings. It's all over. I'm just like my grandmother. There's something seriously wrong with me. The principal who was retiring and brought me into his office a couple of weeks before he retired, who said, "Wilby, I've been dealing with guys like you all my life, working life, and I'm convinced you're going to end up dangling at the end of a rope." I started to say, okay, there's something really wrong. But I also was just a few minutes away from the syringe that could go into my hip and take me out of my misery for a short period of time. 2 weeks lasted 7.5 months. For the next 4 or 5 years, it was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. And every time they released me, this time it was going to be different. And you know something? I was right. It always was different. It just got worse.
And I've had some experiences. I've done it all, okay? Therapeutic communities, poetry therapy. They put me to sleep once for a whole week. Some shrink come in from England, and I guess they were putting people to sleep for a week, and I'll tell you, I just as soon die as go through that again. But one of the sojourns, Tom showed up. And Tom had been sober in this program for about 5 years or so. Stopped going to meetings. And he rearranged a hotel one night, and they thought that was a bit crazy, so they put him in a room with me. And Tom talked to me about going to some Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And down I went. They had a constant on to make sure I didn't run away. And I heard a couple of fantastic stories. Guy had been a top NASCAR driver, what have you, and lost his job because of his drinking and drugging. The woman who took her husband's life in a blackout and couldn't remember it, and served a short period of time for manslaughter, sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I carried a little card they handed out that night, still in my wallet, in your car. It's kind of getting yellow now, you know, the one with the steps and traditions. And here I was living in hell, and the key to that gate was in my left hip pocket. But just prior, or in around the time, just after the ball game, I guess, the missed ball game, I found myself going into one of those evangelical churches. You know what they do, the altar call? This is a call, and there's a big church. I mean, it was this huge. And I didn't know what I was doing. I thought the old stained glass windows were going to come in because, you know, I'm looking over at the, having bad thoughts about the minister's wife. But I remember going up to the altar. And you have to understand this. I wish my prayers this morning were to the same degree they were at that point. But I cried out, if there's a God, please help me. When I got up off my knees, that big crowd had dissipated. There were just a few people around. And one of them was Tom. And Tom said, Jeff, I don't know why I came here this evening. But I'm back and I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've just cried out, please help me. And everything in my basic in my soul. My answer was, Tom, I love the guy. I think we alcoholics love each other. I said, Tom, that's great. It's not my problem. You know, I was in this program, dry for about a year. I cleared up a bit and I remembered that I'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings when I was 16 years of age. Obviously, the courts had sent me. And I remember once being in a holding cell where the police officers in that town were sort of kicking some of the boys from up the tracks into the cells and said, "Will be that you?" And of course, I couldn't see that at all. My last drunk was violent, and but for God's grace, I could have taken people close to me's lives. And I'm going to come around to that. There'll be a reason I'm telling you that. The physicians had already told me that I had 6 months to live if I kept on drinking. My liver, like many of yours, had expanded. My systems were closing down. Again, my thought was, well, if that's the case, then I'm going out in a blaze of glory. I found myself one more time strapped down in an ambulance, heading a couple of hours down to Lockwood and Ontario Hospital, psychiatric hospital. And my only wish there was they give me the dignity to walk into the hospital rather than have the goons, okay, the people, the attendants sort of dragging me in. And you know, it really doesn't matter if the sign out front of the building says hospital. If you're in a room where there's no furniture, the walls are padded, you don't have any clothes on, there's six guys holding you down. I'm going to tell you, you're in the hole. Something was working in my life, though. There was a lady who came to see me. And one just near that end, it gets a little foggy for me. And her message to me that God loved me just the way I was. There's no way I could buy that. I didn't love me, and there weren't too many people loving me. At that point, my family, I believe, was waiting for the knock on the door to see some police officers to say it was all over. I either drowned in a ditch, ran another car into a tree, or whatever. And I really believe that their first emotion would have been relief. Now, they would have felt bad about that. And they would have, then got sad. Here was a life that needlessly was gone. But that's the feelings it would be. But I'll tell you, this higher power
does for me what I cannot do for myself. The shrink called a recovery home. I really expected to go to a place called Penetanguishene for the criminally insane. Part of me wanted to go. I knew I was out of control. But here's how the higher power works. She called this guy who ran this recovery home and said, this guy is a bad case. We'll send him out to you. We're going to give him one last chance. We're not going to take him off the hospital rolls because he'll be back. And Jim, my sponsor, member of this program, said, well, the worse they are, the better we like them. And I just entered the recovery home. Now, I believed it was working for you. I didn't believe it could work for me. And you know, you don't have to be a PhD to reach guys like me. One of the stories I love to tell is the key was the key. Jim said to me one day, Jeff, I got to go downtown. I want you to do something for me. I would like you, with the phone rings, here's the key to the office door, go in, answer the phone, take the message, lock the door up. You want to know something? The phone rang. I went in, I got the message, I locked the door. He trusted me. I kind of had some suspicion. He denies it. I was having dinner with him last week. I believe he might not even gone downtown, but that was a test. But it was something that somebody trusted in me. And slowly, he said to me, get on your knees and ask for help. What do you have to lose? Doesn't matter whether you believe, just do it. And started doing that. And you want to know something? Shortly after that, I was asked to go work in this halfway house with the guys being released from prison. And it's been over 30 years I've been involved in this area and been very privileged to do so, including writing that report. I took my fourth and fifth step and went up and seen Joe. Joe was a member of this program and a Roman Catholic priest. And I heard Joe speak, and he was talking about being down in Detroit on a bender and with a lady of the night, and he couldn't remember whether he had or hadn't, but apparently the bishop didn't like it very much, and he had some difficulty with it. Also, yeah, I was talking about this. I had the privilege of being on a spiritual panel, a major conference in a town called London, Ontario, here a couple of weeks ago. And that room was so important to me because I was just in this recovery home about 6 weeks or so, and somebody gave me a ticket to go to this conference. And they gave me a banquet ticket. And these guys used to do it really, really up on that banquet. They'd have a piper come in and pipe the head table up, the people who were speaking. And I'll be dang if he didn't play Amazing Grace. And I had my AA cry. And there was a big guy there who closed the conference off back in 1975. And he lost his job. He was from Coleman, Alabama. Hillary D. And he lost his job as the abbot, the head of a seminary, because I guess the Pope didn't like drunken adults. I don't know. And he said something really important. He said, never mind how the jackass got in the ditch. And with that good Alabama accent, just geed him out. And interesting enough, when I went up to shake his hand, okay, huge man. He asked me if I was working. And I said, well, no. Working, I couldn't even tie my shoes. I now look back on that and say, intuitively, he knew something. I'm a dumb old country boy. And God has done for me what I could not do for myself. Well, I come back from doing my fifth step with Joe, and I remember it clearly. He said, any questions, Jeff? I said, Joe, have I done it? Or am I just BSing myself again? I've known a lot about fear in my life, but the biggest fear I saw when I came in and read How It Works, there are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I've been telling lies to everybody and myself. In fact, I could be up here lying right now. I'm trying not to, but I could be, okay, because I'm not completely sure what's real and what's not. He said, you did a great job, Jeff. Symbolically, he took me out to old country of Mance, and we tore up. It was kind of a miserable kind of day like this, okay? Tore up the 35 pages of gobbledygook and threw it in the fire. He said, it's finished. Now, I just saw my buddy Gary, who we come in the program at the same time, and he'd gone down his fourth and fifth step, and I could see something different in him. It was there, a calmness, a look in his eye. I was still agonizing. Went home, read the big book, went down to the cathedral, sat there for a while, and the feelings weren't going away. And what happened was, or what was happening was, my parents had forgiven me, And my friends have forgiven me. Hell, the Queen even forgave me. I've got a pardon. Okay, from the Queen. Challenge was, I couldn't forgive me. I still struggle with that a little bit. This is the old timer. His name was Joe P. And Joe always finished his talks like this. I'm not finished yet, okay? Hang with me. But it popped into my head, so it's coming out. And Joe always finished these talks like this. Thank God I feel comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. But please God, never so comfortable that I should forget. The higher power, I was by myself for about 8 years. I used to call me Jeff the Monk. Because I knew that I didn't have the capacity to be involved with a relationship. It talks about it, I think in the 12 and 12, it says that we alcoholics never had a real relationship with anyone. And I remember reading that and really identifying. So the first thing I needed to do was to become a good AA member. Stack up the chairs. Nobody makes me make coffee. It's terrible. But becoming a good AA member. A good member of the fellowship. Then do we learn how to become a friend. And then actually have female friends. That was really a growth period for me. And then I started hanging around some of those earth people. And, you know, they weren't half in. First 4 or 5 years, if you weren't in this program, get away from that. I don't want to talk to you. And then this sponsor of mine says, Jeff, I met this girl in Stratford. That was about an hour away from where I lived. He said, I think you're just two peas in a pod. And I said to him, Jim, look, the last thing I need is a woman in my life. And secondly, why would I drive all the way up to Stratford? I'll get somebody in the East End of London. I'll save on gas. But the higher power sent a snowstorm. We got snowed in 1983, and we're still together. And we have a good relationship. We're buds. All of a sudden, we got a call telling me that Kira Celine had arrived. She's now 17. Can't believe it. We're going to give her a Christmas present and some driving lessons. I'm going to give her a car. I'm able to do that because I'm in recovery. Now, I want to tell you this. Joe Pinner said, you know, that I should not forget. About 4 or 5 years ago in this addictions field, I was down to something called the Providence Summit. And in that summit, all the gurus in the American scene here were at this summit. They invited me back the second year to this summit and asked me to facilitate a workshop, which I did. And I was leaving the summit, the conference. I had about 6 or 7 hours. I spent 6 or 7 hours in Toronto Airport today, but before my next for the flight. And it was a wonderful June day, and if you know Providence, Rhode Island, they got that river sort of running through the town. And I got myself a Starbucks and had my book, and I sat down by the stream. And all of a sudden, I heard another voice that said, "How are you, sir?" And I thought, "Oh God, he's going to put the touch on me. I just want to sit here and have peaceful and have a coffee." And I had a real attitude. And I said to him, "Okay, how are you?" He said, "Well, I'm not very good." My attitude was still there. "Yeah, so what's your problem?" He said, "I'm drinking again." Something inside of me said to Mark, "Sit down." And we talked for an hour. Mark didn't smell very good. An hour later, he had wet cheeks and so did I. I gave him $10, American, and said, "You know what to do, Mark. You know where the detox is. So you can go get a bowl of soup before you go, or go get a cheap bottle of wine, whatever it is that you want to do." And Mark got, and I stood up. We hugged each other. He still didn't smell very good. God sent me an angel. I don't know what happened with Mark, but I do know what happened was with Jeff. When I got on the plane, I realized I was sent a message, not to get so cocky. And so it's a privilege for me to be here. Probably I'm the guy that's really getting helped here. Well, I share things I need to remind myself that I'm living one day at a time. I have a daily reprieve contingent upon my spiritual condition. And obviously my spiritual condition wasn't very good that day in Providence, Rhode Island. I wasn't grateful. I woke up 2 years ago. I'm getting close to the end. And I said to my wife, "I don't know what that was, but that was no dream." "What was it?" she said. I said, "I don't know."
But it wasn't like a dream. It wasn't like a regular dream. I thought something's happened. Went to church, came home. I went into my office the next day, facing those 100 emails that are there every morning. And there's one from my youngest son, who I hadn't seen or heard from in 16 years. Just prior to that, I'd agreed with the minister of the church that I go to give, she said, I'm going to do a series in January on the 12 steps. But I can't be there the third week. Will you do 6, 7, and 8? When I closed off that speech or whatever, I said, 2 hours from now, I'll be in London to meet with my youngest son. There wasn't a dry eye in the house. And as I was driving down, this is the growth in my recovery. I thought, okay, if he wants to rag on me, I'll let him rag on me for about 20 minutes or a half hour. And I'll say, okay, you've had your say, and I'll move on. My self-esteem had grown to the point to say, no, I don't have to go down and get whipped. That didn't happen at all. We met. He showed me the pictures of his children. We talked about hockey. And when I got into my car, Diane called me and said, well, what happened? I said, you know something? He's just a fine young man. And he's had the privilege of having a Damascus Road experience, similar to Bill Wilson. And very, very spiritual in a sense. And then I remembered that a few weeks prior to that email, I was driving along and the thought occurred to me that maybe I should change my thinking about him and his brother, who I haven't seen in 18 years or so. I didn't change my thinking. I just thought about changing my thinking. And I believed that that's the mustard seed. That's all I needed to do. And the reason that he wanted to get together was that he was seeing a counselor and having flashbacks of that last night. He was 6 years old. And what he remembers was totally frightened. Police officers, hobnail boots downstairs, guns drawn. And his little six-year-old mind was, somebody's going to die tonight, it's going to be my daddy. So what a privilege it is for me then to be at his home on Boxing Day with his two children. And that is evolving. You know, Di and I were last year, like we had some business to do in New York, and we had been to the Wilson House up in East Dorset in Vermont a couple of times. If you haven't been there, go. To go to Bill and Lois's graves, very humble, people's medallions around. I mean, here is a man who Aldous Huxley referred to as the greatest social architect of the 20th century in humble, humble graves. And even the story of Ziggy and doing, you know, how the Wilson House got retrieved and the foundation was set up. It's really worthwhile going. Last year, something I had wanted to do for a long time, I was able to go to Stepping Stones. And to be there where Bill wrote a lot of his books, and that humble home as well. I remember going off, I used to go off on my personal retreats. I remember going off to a retreat center, and I'm not Catholic, but just the Catholic retreat center. I remember one time, the head nun was coming to me and said, you know, it was a bit of a blazing snowstorm. She said, you know, you people in Alcoholics Anonymous are our most favorite people. But I don't think you really know what you've been given. I thought she was saying we were ungrateful. That wasn't what she was saying. She was saying how privileged we are to be in this program. And let's face it, not all of us get here. A Episcopalian priest once said to me, having lunch, Jeff, you know, we're both ordained. I by the church, but you by God. And I will say to you that each one of us in this room are ordained in that sense. We've been given a life in recovery. My job is just to share it when I'm called to do so. So it is no big burden for me to fly down, Chris, to and Mary Beth to address here. Let me say this. I wear a silver feather. It's a lapel pin. If you want one, come up and see me later on. If you're interested, I'll give you one. Because it's the tail feather of the bird that allows it to rise to great heights. Our book talks about that. It talks about taking our rightful spot in society. And from coming from where people would have been relieved to find out I wasn't here, I always say my funeral back then, there'd be two people who showed up, and both of them been cops to make sure I was gone. But I've been given that rightful spot in society in many, 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 many ways.
And I also want to, I equate the Canada geese with our program. As you know, they get together. They say, okay, we'll get... Now, scientists are saying that they are among the most highest communicating creatures outside of our human beings. But as you know, they're always squawking. Sound like a whole... Everybody's squawking. You get the lead bird. And I really believe they're saying, okay, hey, Jennifer, keep going, gal. And when you get tired, you can drop back and one of us will take over. And that has happened for me time and time again, where members of this program have grabbed me as I'm going over the cliff. And so I think that the Canada geese, as they fly down together, supporting each other, is very much what I've experienced here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I think I've had a small spiritual awakening. So I remember a fellow come in, he said, he was an older guy, thought he must have been 65, that's like me. And he come in late in life, and he said he didn't know about a spiritual awakening, but he sure as well had a rude one. And I've had a lot of rude ones. My job is to share, and all of our jobs is to share and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And what are those principles? In the 12 and 12, it talks about what St. Francis of Assisi said, that I am to understand rather than to understood. Be understood. Now, you're probably meeting somebody who probably never met one like me before, but I'm one of those attention-seeking alcoholics. I am to love rather than to be loved. I'm, as a selfish, self-centered alcoholic, are learning a little bit about that. When I was asked to give my first AA sharing or talk, I did so back at the psychiatric hospital that I had spent so much time in. And I was real concerned about walking in there and people recognized me. This is about 4 or 5 months into the program or 6 months into the fellowship, and people said they won't even recognize you. An old Andy F., I don't know if any of you have been to the World Conference in Toronto 3 years ago, but they have an old-timers panel, as you know. And my wife had almost nailed my shoes to the floor, because two of the old-timers who were up there were two guys who had a great deal of influence in my sobriety. One, Andy F. And Andy said, I've been in this program for 40 years, you're the only guy I've ever seen come in the program with his shoes on. And I finished the talk that night, or afternoon, or whatever it was, in this manner. And with your indulgence, I'd like to close in the same way. You know, they say, you want to speak, whether it's here or professionally, you know, stand up so you can be seen, speak up so you can be heard, shut up so you can be appreciated. I gave the close the talk. There was another spiritual leader who told the story of a man who had two sons. And one was very much like my brother Brian. He stayed on the farm, you know, did what the old man told him. And one was very much like me, so I'm out of here. Give me my dowry. I'm going to go chase wine, women, and song. The only thing I was ever good at was I couldn't sing with a dang. Couldn't do relationships. I just did the wine. As you recall that story, if you remember, you know, if you were taught that story, is that he said, I'm better off to go back to my father's plantation and be a slave. He should have something to eat. He was fed up. He was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And as we know, the father greeted him. He greeted him, killed the fatted lamb, put a wonderful piece of clothing on him, and welcomed him home. When I first sat in a meeting and said, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic, my next thought was, what in the world did you say that for? But you know, always coming in, I'm on the plane, Chris and Mary Beth pick me up, and there's this doubt, you know, really, what have I got to share? This is what I have to share. And I stood up here and said, my name is Jeff and I'm an alcoholic. I knew that I was at home. Thank you very much.